이제 지대비 돼. 뺀다 지대비 뺀다.
So Master Tsongkhapa says he's very delighted to follow the Buddha's teaching, which actually does away with all the antagonist views, and which actually bestows the two interests of all sentient beings. And all the different religious traditions of the world have different beliefs in different deities or whatever you call them. When people actually faced problems, they sought some higher path, someone in whom they wish to keep their hope, put their hope. When they are unable to deal with the problems and difficulties in each a small village, when people have problems, they just relied on or propitiated some kind of a deity or spirit, and there is not much philosophical background to these. But then we have the major religious traditions of the world with philosophical background, and all teach love, compassion, contentment, tolerance, self-discipline, and so forth. So all these traditions are helpful to humanity. And therefore, so I may say that so harmony within the community, monastic community, is happiness and so forth. As although there are many different philosophical, different philosophies in the different religious traditions, but we should not use that as we have the 18 different subsections of Vaibhashikas, which have to be live harmoniously, and therefore we can extend the same logic to other religious traditions, saying that this is my religion and that is their religion, and then making this division. We should not do that, rather bring ourselves close to each other. And so as Master Tsongkhapa says, that the Buddha's teaching is free from all kinds of contradictions and gives the fulfills the hopes of both the hopes or interests of the sentient beings. And so the teaching is such that we have reason to support it, to prove and demonstrate the truth of this teaching, and we can introduce the teaching and explain it based on reason and logic. And therefore, an intelligent one, the more he or she scrutinizes this teaching, would gain greater certainty in this teaching. And so, as Lama Tsongkhapa says, it overcomes all opposing challenges. So sometimes when you resort only to scriptural authority alone without using reason, then you would have to say, oh, this is something mystery, or we cannot, and then you would have to accept the contradictions within the teachings. But because of the law of dependent origination in terms of causality, the practice of the teaching leads to higher rebirth, and because of dependence in terms of designation, you are led to the goal of enlightenment. It's free from contradictions between earlier and later paths. And then within the teaching of the Buddha, of course, there are the teachings of the Shravakas and Pratika Buddhas, and then also the Bodhisattva Yana. And the difference between these basic lower vehicles and the higher vehicle, greater vehicle, is lies in the broadness of one's attitude. So, of course, there are some practices which are sometimes allowed, and then certain practices which are prohibited. And these are in accordance with the purpose and the reason to do so. So we have, of course, within our own system, but different philosophical systems. And within the Chittamatrins, there are different philosophical sub-schools, and within Madhyamakas also. And so today we'll come across the difference between the Savatantrika Madhyamakas and Prasangika Madhyamakas. All these different philosophical systems are because of the mental predispositions of the followers. But despite that, when one's own system is being demonstrated and established, then it's quite natural to try to check and examine the positions of others' systems as well, as Master Tsongkhapa does, reading the different Indian classic texts such as Bhavviveka, where the Bhavviveka examines the interpretation of Buddha Palita, and Buddha Palita Bhavviveka also does examine all the different philosophical systems that existed in India, such as the non-Buddhist traditions as well. And then Master Chandrakirti also examines and puts to test the Bhavviveka's criticism of Buddha Palita in his... But Master Chandrakirti says that the reason why the classic texts, classic texts we find criticism and scrutiny of other system is not in order to create this attachment to one's own attachment to one's own system and aversion to others, but this is to show us the path to liberation. And therefore he says that we should not attach to the our own systems. We should not do criticism without attachment to our own system and aversion to others. But we should use our intelligence to scrutinize the teachings. And so these, although we find all these criticisms and back and forth between the twin masters, sometimes having learned these, and it's we tend to actually attach to our own way of understanding, our own way of interpreting the things. So we have to examine the teachings themselves by relying on the great authoritative masters who have actually done their own critical analysis of these teachings. So having learned these, as a result of it, if we actually turn these criticisms to create more bias, then it is not good. So we are all, Tibetan Buddhist traditions, all follow the Nalanda, the pure Nalanda tradition, and going back, the tradition of Rishandra Rakshita, and so forth. But we talk about the Nyingma tradition, and within the Nyingma also, and then the earlier and later Therma traditions. And then if we talk about the Nyingma in general, we have the Kama tradition, and then the Therma tradition, which is actually used to clarify the teachings in more clearly. And then there are times where there are occasions when the Therdens, the treasure revealers themselves, between themselves, there are criticism. Then in the Kagyu also, there are these different criticisms, and also they're done through, which are also done through attachment. And therefore, we have sectarianism. And so we have to differentiate between using the intelligence and putting as the basis, the witness, like the teaching of the Buddha itself. But not create sectarianism. Otherwise, like then Bhava Viveka's criticism of Buddha Palita would also tantamount to be create sectarianism, and then Chandrakirti's criticism of Buddha, Bhava Viveka also doing the same. So having done critical analysis of the teachings, if we actually create more discord between the different traditions, then it's not good. I usually tell this story. We had once one interfaith dialogue, and there was one scientist from in Argentina. There was a scientist whose research field was quantum physics. And so he said that he was a researcher, an expert, specializes in quantum physics, but he was not attached to his own field of research. And similarly, we Tibetan Buddhist traditions, Kagyu Nyingma Sakya, and there is no separate Kadam traditions these days, but Geluk. But at some point of time, we have made distinctions between the different Tibetan Buddhist traditions on the basis of the hats, which is really a difficult thing to stand to the test of reasoning. If you put a hat, red hat on a donkey, and when a yellow hat on a donkey, and tell said this is Nyingma Panyi, this is the other one is yellow, and so forth, it's not good. So Kongdang Tenpi Dome says that by merely wearing the saffron hat does not mean you are a protector or this you're preserving the teaching of Lama Tsongkhapa. But while wearing this saffron hat, with not knowing the 18 volumes of writings, text of Tsongkhapa, and particularly the Middle Way tradition, and also not Lamrim Chemo of the Sutrayana and Ngagrim Chemo of the Tantrayana. If you just say, I'm Gelugpa, there's nothing really great about you. And then, if you're a Dzogchenpa, then you should know the progressive path, the basis, the path, and the fruition, and then be able to go into Dzogchen practice, where you are able to, within being a Dzogchen practitioner, you should be able to explain the teaching of the nine yanas, beginning with the basic yana, and then up to that of the taking or transforming the transformation into the primordial wisdom as the path. So otherwise, it's very difficult to please the scholars or the learned ones. And then within the Kagyu tradition, we have the eight, the four major and the eight minors. And you have to know the entire system of one's own entire system of the presentation of the Dharma. So in the writings of the past masters, there are writings which pertain to the general presentation of the Dharma, and there are writings which pertain to only very specific disciples. So when you talk about the general, the overall structure of the Dharma, you should be able to actually explain the Dharma accordingly. But then there are the Doha teachings, the songs of experiential songs of the Mahasiddhas, which actually are meant for very specific disciples and not meant as a general teaching for the beginner levels and so forth. And one of the Doha teachings, Gopi, says that the medicine for those who need the simultaneous path, the spontaneous path, will actually turn into poison for those who have to train on the path gradually. So this is what he says. And similarly, the great medicine for those of the gradual path will turn into poison for those who need this spontaneous or the simultaneous path. And therefore, you have to be able to differentiate between these two approaches. And otherwise, you'll have internal contradiction within yourself, inconsistency within yourself, your own positions. So, after becoming refugees, have been very harmonious, mainly thanks to the religious heads like Sakya Dr. Rinpoche and Karmapa Rinpoches, and then Minling Tichen Rinpoches, and so forth. So because of these great masters, we have a very harmonious community of Tibetan community. And we could actually very frankly talk to each other and to discuss about the different points. And then there's the Jonang tradition, which says Shentong, the extrinsic view of the middle way. And so if we can have this kind of atmosphere of friendship and friendliness, then we will have a very... called peaceful sort of situation within ourselves. So it's when we talk about being harmonious and being keeping our moral ethics purely, it's not just talking about them, but being actually practicing them in our hearts. And then after coming into exile, we have the study of Pramana or the logic and epistemology, the best study of Pramana is done in the Geluk tradition. Of course, in the Sakya, they used to have a very good tradition, but later the Gelugpas became have the best study of the Pramana, and so the other traditions can learn from these. During the Gajang Gunchu, the monastic, inter-monastic debate congregation. And we can also study, the other traditions also can study Sakya Pandita's treasury of logic as well. Otherwise, as Master Vasubandhu says, the eye of the world has now closed. And then those with bad understanding and conceptions actually disturb the Dharma. And so the Dharma has now declined that we have to actually be very careful about preserving it. So at such a situation, there's no point in actually talking about us and they and making this different distinction between ourselves. Otherwise, it will be a cause to create, to engage in indulgent misdeeds in the name of religion. So it is very important for all of us to live in harmony. And therefore, for this reason, this is one of the reasons why I banned the. I've been saying that the practice of Shugden is not good. If you have to say that a Gelugpa cannot touch or have a text of a Nyingma tradition in their house, of course it's not good. So of course this is just under. Side that I'm talking about it. In the recent times, inside Tibet as well as in exile, in our exile community, of course, over 99% of Tibetans, having seen reason, the good reason in what I have been saying about Dogyal, they have stopped propitiating Dogyal, but most people, of course, were not propitiating this spirit. So I do not need to repeat this over and over again. So in this time, when I have been giving teaching here, there was no time that I had to raise this issue. But some, out of ignorance. And inside Tibet, there are people who say that the Gelug monastic institutions like Sayarat, Garden, and Drepung have actually become Nyingma monasteries because they have stopped propitiation of Shugden. So this is total nonsense. So out of their ignorance, people are saying this, and some even say this intentionally. So even during the time of the Buddha, there were criticisms of the Buddha himself as well. So if relying on the Shugden can actually lead you to liberation, then of course it's good. But the 13th Dalai Lama has said that by relying on, by worshipping Shugden, you actually go against the precept of taking refuge in the three jewels with the Dharma and Sangha. So we have this tradition or practice within the Tibetan community to visit temples, and when you're in front of the Buddha statues, of course you may be saying, oh, I take refuge in you, and maybe that's all. You don't actually make prayers for your own success in your practice and so forth. But once you are in the Gyeonkang part of the temple, which is the protector's room, shrine, then you make all kinds of prayers. And in worst-case scenarios, you may even pray that your enemy would not have success and that they may be overcome and so forth, which is not at all good. And so the 5th Dalai Lama himself has said the nature, the cause, and the function of Dogyal. So this is his words are authoritative. And so when the different teachers of the tradition, different Tibetan Buddhist traditions teach their students how to be a sectarian, then this is not good. They are teaching them attachment towards their own religious tradition. So it is very important for us to understand the general presentation, the general overall structure of the Buddhism well, and live in harmony amongst ourselves, all the Tibetan Buddhist traditions. In Lamrim Chemung, Jay Rinpoche says, we have come to this section on the demonstration or establishment of middle way philosophy, the third wall, the insight section. Page 237, paragraph 2, which ends with this citation from Clear Words of Chandrakirti. Thus, our position is completely pure. So there, it's all stopped. Yesterday, so accordingly, even if you do not know how to set forth a perfect system of the Madhyamaka scholars, you should at least not slander it by claiming that it does not exist. The very acceptance of the reasoning of dependent arising cuts through the... So thus, our position is completely pure of any logical flaws and definitely does not contradict any traditional presentation of the conventional or ultimate reality, while your position has obvious and serious flaws and does not contradict... The Madhyamaka system mentioned in this previously cited passage is an irrefutable presentation deriving from both from the cognition of that determine what is ultimate and from conventional valid cognitions. Hence, you can be certain that it is completely pure of logical flaw and that it allows you to make a complete exposition of cycling existence and nirvana, or else if the claim Madhyamakas have no system of their own were considered irrefutable, then the claim everything that you say is a lie could also not be refuted even the slightest degree for similar reasons. Objection. And then the reply. And then the quotation from commentary on the middle way. And then the paragraph after that, 238. Suppose you argue that you can engage in analysis as follows. If the Vatsipatriyas claim that the person substantially exists, it is incorrect for them to hold that the person cannot be described in terms of those aggregates, as it would contradict their view that person is neither the same as aggregates nor different from them. If you do make this argument, then... If you do make this argument, then by the same token, the very statement, if I is nothing, I have no assertion, constitutes a sincere claim. You might argue that the following two situations are similar, saying we have no wealth, and receiving the reply, give me that wealth which is no wealth, and saying that we accept nothing, and receiving the reply, the acceptance of nothingness itself accepting something. However, in making this argument, you and misunderstand our position. We are not claiming that not having assertions is itself an assertion. Well, then, what are we saying? We are demonstrating that by sincerely claiming that you assert nothing, you necessarily assert that you are asserting nothing. As a result, you inevitably cancel out your own words. If claims like the ones you make do not belong to the Mudembaka system, then you contradict yourself by proving them through the citation of passages from the works of the noble Nagarjuna and his spiritual son Aryadeva. Also, such claims cannot be considered the system of Chandrakirti nor the system of any other Buddhist. Thus, they fall outside the teaching. Those who claim to advocate the Madhyamaka system, and in particular the system of Chandrakirti, contradict themselves by claiming to have no system of their own. Likewise, it is also incorrect to claim that everything that you set forth is posited only in terms of the perspective of others. In this way, hoping to free yourself from the asserting anything, when you say that you must assert the existence of things such as form only in terms of the perspectives of others, you may not be asserting the existence of things such as form, but you certainly must be asserting that you posit form and such in terms of the perspective of others, so you have not freed yourself from all assertions. You have to assert that at that time there is one another person in terms of whose perspective you posit things, and two, yourself, the one who posits them. Therefore, the claim that you accept nothing only in terms of perspective of others not only fails to imply that you have no system of your own, it actually vitiates against such a notion. Objection, we do not claim even that we have no system or that we assert thesis only in terms of perspective of others. However, from your point of view, it appears that we make these claims. Reply, this position denies sensory experience that even the Lokayatas cannot deny. When you do not even experience what you yourself claim, how surprising that you should know what we have heard. If you do deny the evidence of sensory experience, then why do you need to insist that you have no assertion? For no matter what you claim, you can deny it later and thus never be faulted. Opponent, we positively reduct your arguments only in terms of the perspective of others. We do not accept them in our own system. Reply, then what does it mean for you to repudiate the Savatantrika system and to have faith in the system of Chandrakirti, the textual founder of the Prasangika system? For just as the autonomous syllogism is inadmissible in your own system, so too reductio arguments are inadmissible. Just as reductio arguments are inadmissible in terms of perspective of others, you also end up using autonomous syllogisms, as indeed in terms of the perspectives of others. We cannot call those persons Chittamatrins who accept mind-only philosophy in terms of the perspective of others, but who do not accept it in their own system. Likewise, we cannot call those persons Prasangikas who, while not allowing in their own system reductive arguments that establish the meaning of the middle way, nonetheless posit them in terms of the perspective of others. And since those who advocate this position are also not Savatantrikas, this clearly shows that they are not Madhyamakas. Chandrakirti's commentary on Madhyamaka Avatara states, I say this, they exist for the effect, even though they do not. Taking the perspective of the world, I speak of for itself. You cannot use this as a source to prove that all positions are taken only in terms of the perspective of others. Why? One posits phenomena as lacking essential or as intrinsic nature only in the purview of reasoned knowledge that properly analyzes whether such a nature exists. One does not posit this in the purview of an ordinary conventional consciousness. Why? Were that ordinary consciousness able to establish the lack of intrinsic nature, then reasoned knowledge would be pointless, which is absurd. Also, since that same text says, I say they exist, taking the perspective of the world, it means that the existence of forms and such is posited in terms of the perspective of the world. When that text, in the lines prior to those just cited, states that we do not accept the conventional, it means that we do not accept dependent entities as Chittamatra accepts them. It does not mean that we do not in our own system accept the conventional, for it says real dependent entities such as you accept. This stands a response to a Chittamatra argument given the transitional passage of the commentary on that text. If you use what is valid or reasonable to refute dependent entities, I will use your arguments to refute what you consider the conventional. Hence, the meaning is this. You, Chittamatrins, believe dependent entities to be things that can withstand rational analysis. I do not accept such conventional phenomena. Hence, we disagree as to whether one can use reason to refute them. We do not take the expression taking the perspective of the world to refer to the perspective of others who do not belong to our own system. Rather, it refers to unimpaired conventional consciousness. This is because the existence of conventional objects must always be posited within the purview of such consciousness, such a consciousness, and because the valid cognitions that posit conventionalities exist even in the Madhyamaka's own mind stream. Therefore, we take the words, even though they do not exist, to refer to their lack of existence by way of intrinsic character. So the passage should be glossed as, I tell them they exist, even though they do not exist by way of their intrinsic character. It is inappropriate to gloss it as, I say that they exist, even though they do not exist. This is because this passage represents our way of positing conventional objects in which existence by way of intrinsic character is not possible, even conventionally. Also, in the portion of his commentary on the Middle Way, what explains that passage, Chandrakirti states that I accept whatever exists or does not exist for the world just as the world does. Thus, that passage cannot be taken to mean that things do not exist. Therefore, since there are many such instances in which the text states that even though things do not ultimately exist, they nonetheless exist conventionally, there is not the slightest fault in taking the existence that is affirmed and the existence that is denied as having different meanings in the passage. I say they exist even though they do not exist. Objection. You still have to explain what Nagarjuna's refutation of objections means when it says that Madhyamakas have no position and thesis. If you adopt the thesis, the seedling has no essential or intrinsic nature, then you also have to accept the reason, because it is a dependently arisen thing. And for example, like a reflected image. Accordingly, you accept that a syllogistic statement creates for the proponent, one, a reason that has bearing on the subject and has the two forms of privations, and number two, a probandum that the reason proves, and three, an inference that understands that probandum. This being the case, then, aside from simply hating the name autonomous syllogism, why do you go to the trouble of refuting autonomous syllogisms? Reply, the refutation of objections does explain what we have no thesis and positions, just as you have cited it. But since there are also many passages that state that it is necessary to posit assertions, how can simply citing that one passage prove that Madhyamakas have no positions? It is quite true, however, that there has been concern that anyone who holds this absence of intrinsic existence as a thesis is a Savatantrika. This is because this is an exceedingly subtle and difficult point. Our response to that will be explained when we set forth our own position. Wow. So His Holiness was commenting on the last stanza on page 244, quoting Lama Tsongkhapa, saying that if there is intrinsic nature in things, then we cannot overcome all the elaborations or mental reifications. The clear word passage that states the opposite of the absurd consequence in a reductio pertains to the opponents, 245, pertains to the opponent but not to ourselves, for we have no thesis, can also be taken as a source to prove that Madhyamakas have no system of their own, for that passage means that they have no autonomous thesis. Whereabout the commentary on the Middle Way passage in which Chandrakirti says that he has no position, in his own system, Chandrakirti holds that neither is refutation nor the position he is refuting exist intrinsically. Therefore, when he uses reasoned analysis to refute the other party's belief that causes intrinsically give rise to their effects, asking whether causes give rise to effects through contact with them or without contact with them, this refutation does not apply to Chandrakirti himself because he does not have to assert things that can withstand rational analysis. This is what that passage means. It does not at all imply that we have no system of our own. For Chandrakirti's explanation of the Middle Way commentary, comments on that passage. We do not fall into a similar absurdity in our own system because from our perspective the refutation does not refute what it refutes by contacting it, nor does the refutation refute what it refutes without contacting it. This is because neither the refutation nor what it refutes intrinsically exists. Therefore, we do not consider whether they make contact. Why is the rational analysis proposed by the essentialist not applicable to the Madhyamaka refutation? He says it is because the refutation and what it refutes do not intrinsically exist. He does not say that it is because Madhyamakas have no assertions. In support, he cites Perfection of Wisdom Sutra in 25,000 lines, where Shariputra investigates and asks Subhuti about what kind of phenomenon, produced or unproduced, brings about the attainment of an unproduced phenomena. After Shariputra has refuted that either kind brings it about, he then asks, is it that there is no attainment and no clear knowledge? And Subhuti says, as in the earlier citation, that these two do exist, but not dualistically. Using this as an example, Chandrakirti's explanation of the Middle Way commentary gives this explanation because it would lead to such a dualistic absurdities. Such dualistic absurdities, the sutra denies that a produced or unproduced phenomenon brings about attainment. Moreover, as dualistic analysis is inappropriate in the absence of real things, attainment is accepted without analysis. According to the conventions of the world, likewise, it is neither that a refutation and what it refutes come into contact, nor is it that they do not come into contact. Nonetheless, you should realize that conventionally a refutation refutes what is to be refuted. This clearly states that when analyzed in terms of contact or non-contact, refutation does not exist in either way. But since this analysis does not deny the existence of refutation, Madhyamakas must accept that conventionally there are refutations of the positions taken by others. What is more, Chandrakirti also accepts that the fact that a syllogistic reason establishes the probandum, how so? And in another passage that immediately follows that the one cited above, his commentary on the Middle Way, an explanation of that commentary states, you can see the details of the orb of the sun, such as an eclipse, even in the reflection of the sun. It is unreasonable to ask whether the sun and its images come in contact. Yet this does occur in a merely conventional independent way. A reflection is not something that is true, but in order to make your face beautiful, you treat it as existing. Likewise, the reasoning that you have the power to cleanse wisdom's countenance induced the understanding of the point to be proven, even though they are improper, according to the essentialist logic. This is how it should be understood. Since a reflected image does not exist in the least, it is totally impossible to consider whether it is produced through contact or without contact with the orb of the sun. Nonetheless, when you see a reflection, a nearby form, seeing a reflection in a nearby form that is a causal condition for that reflection, you ascertain the object that you are seeking to understand. Likewise, a refutation that is empty of intrinsic nature refutes what is to be refuted, and a reasoning that is improper and is empty of intrinsic nature proves that point that is to be proven. Since this does not lead to absurdities of a dichotomizing analysis, it is incorrect for you to claim that our own words suffer from absurdity similar to that which we find in your position. This is how you should understand it. Thus, this is how Chandrakirti explains his answer that the arguments we used against others cannot be turned around and used against us. He does not say that we have no system of our own. Moreover, while analysis of whether a A cause produces an effect with or without contact refutes those who accept intrinsic existence. Chandrakirti gives our assertion of the absence of intrinsic existence as the reason why this fault does not apply to us. This is how he avoids that fallacy. He does not avoid it by saying that we have no system of our own. For the explanation of the middle way commentary states, how do we explain production? It is because both cause and effect are like illusions that this is not the fault of us. The things of the world exist. That analysis is applicable to those who maintain that cause and effect respectively are intrinsically characterized as the producer and the produced thing. But what about someone who maintains that since things are generated by false imputation, they are like illusions, in that it is not in their intrinsic nature to be produced? What about someone who holds that things lack intrinsic nature but are the object of mental construction, like the falling hair that may appear to a person with eye disease? That person has no conception of intrinsic production. Therefore, there is no opportunity to fault us in the way just explained. Also, since the things of the world do exist, when left unanalyzed, everything is established. He gives the acceptance of intrinsic character as the reason why fault applies. So we are at the end of the section refuting the fourth misinterpretation on page 249. This fourth system apparently accepts that intrinsic character exists conventionally, but refutes the conventional existence of intrinsic character that withstand rational analysis. We have already explained that this is wrong. It also maintains that in the system of the Master Chandrakirti, when Madhyamakas use other-centered arguments to prove something to essentialist proponents, they use reasons that meet the three criteria and that are established for both systems. This is incorrect. So now we come to the point of making distinction between Prasangikas and Savatantrikas. So Bhavviveka criticizes Buddha Palita for using his ad absurdum the reductio that is given in Buddha Palita's commentary on Master Nagarjuna's text, the fundamental treatise of the Middle Way. So he when Buddha Palita makes comment on the non-production from other self and others and so forth. And so, from that point of view, we can say that Bhavviveka is very kind. We have to feel the gratitude to Bhavviveka for making this point, and which later Master Chandrakirti refuted. So, chapter 20, setting forth our own position, explaining how Prasangika set forth their own system via refutation of Saptantrika brings about an understanding of both systems. So, this is how I will proceed. Chandrakirti's clear word has a great deal to say on this matter, but I'm wary of excessive verbiage, so I will teach only the main points here. There are two divisions, the actual refutation of the autonomous argument, why the faults we find in autonomous arguments are do not apply to us. Regarding the first, there are two. The first of these has two divisions, demonstrating a fault that pertains to position, namely that the basis of the subject of an autonomous syllogism is not established. This section has two parts, stating that what Bhavviveka believes and refuting it. What Bhavviveka believes is the passage from Chandrakirti's clear words on these points appear to be exceedingly difficult to understand, so let me explain by citing and explaining a passage from the clear words. It says, how? In the thesis, sound is impermanent, both the subject and predicate are construed. so without actually being affected by what the philosophical the different philosophical systems interpret, just cognizing the object itself. Is this a comment from His Holiness on this passage? So this means that when the Buddhist advances the thesis, sound is impermanent to the Vaibhicheshikas. If sound that evolves from the element is taken as a subject, it will not be established for the Vaibhicheshikas. If sound as a quality of space is taken as the subject, it will not be established for us. Likewise, when the Vaibhicheshikas themselves advance the thesis, sound is impermanent to those Sankhyas who are manifestationists. If sound as something produced were taken as the subject, it would not be established for the manifestationists. If sound as something that previously exists and comes to be manifest through certain conditions were taken as the subject, it will not be established for Vaisheshika proponents. Therefore, it is impossible to use as a subject something that is incompatible with one's own individual belief system. Given that the subject is the basis that both parties analyze in order to see whether a specific quality is present, it has to be something established as appearing in common to both. So what is meant by the commonly accepted basis of a property? So the valid cognition, which the protagonist actually claim is the mind which is incontrovertible with respect to the object that appears. In the debate where sound is proved to be impermanent, protagonist or the essentially say that there is the cognition is actually non-mistaken in terms of how the thing appears to it, which is to say that there is the appearance of an objective existence, and that is actually true, whereas the antagonist, the Madhyamaka, say that they are not actually true because that way of existence of things is not there at all. And so in the heart of the Madhyamaka by Vaviveka, it is said that all the constructions actually disappear in the face of this uncontaminated path, which is absorbed in emptiness directly. So therefore, when an inaccurate consciousness that takes what is non-existent as existent, as in the case of someone with an eye, so since accurate, inaccurate, Solomon was making comment on that passage on 254, the first paragraph. Now we are on the next paragraph. Since inaccurate and accurate consciousness are different in this way, inaccurate consciousness cannot exist when accurate consciousness is present. So how could the conventional I as the subject of a syllogism exist for an accurate consciousness? Therefore, since there is for Bhava Viveka no avoiding the fallacies of a non-existent position and non-existent reason, the response he has given is no answer at all. I will explain this passage based on the following syllogism, since using this example makes it easier to understand. Subject, visible form, predicate, is not produced from itself. Reason, because it is because it exists. For example, like the pot that is right in front of you. So the object that is found by the inaccurate and the accurate consciousnesses are different. So Master Tsongkhapa is actually commenting on the passage, which says it's inaccurate and accurate and says, so the passages of the clear words that replied Bhava Viveka shows that the subject is not established as appearing in common to the two parties in this debate. How do you show this? Here, in this section, the clear word states that those to whom it demonstrates how one cannot establish a subject in common with an opponent are those who refute production from self, that is, the Savatantrikas. But, in general, the opponents of the clear words are both A, the essentialists who accept things ultimately have intrinsic nature, and the Savatantrikas who refute that, but accept that things conventionally have intrinsic nature, character or intrinsic nature from their own sight. So all these Savatantrikas, including Savatantrikas, these essentialists and say that the consciousness, cognitions, the accurate cognitions are not mistaken with regard to the appearance of objective existence of the things. Savatantrika Madhyamakas are called non-essentialists, however, so as to simplify the terminology in this discussion, opponents of the intrinsic existence will refer to the Prasangikas, and advocates of intrinsic existence will refer to both the essentialists and the Savatantrikas. So according to the advocates of intrinsic existence, visible form, the stated subject of the syllogism must be established by the valid perceptual cognition of the visual consciousness that perceived it. Moreover, if those consciousness did not establish visible form in a non-mistaken way, then they could not be perceptions that establish their objects. Hence, they must be non-mistaken. Do non-conceptual perceptions establish their objects in a non-mistaken way? In non-prasankhika systems, an object's existence by way of its intrinsic character appears to any consciousness that is non-mistaken with respect to that object. So having some understanding of the view of lack of intrinsic existence, although they may use logic and reasoning, but because both the parties have the same view, they have a commonly appearing object. And therefore, for the Prasangikas, these valid cognitions are valid in terms of the what appears to them, the objects appearing to them as object of existence. And so, so this is something that Bhava Viveka himself accepts. What are those subjects, I and form like? Something found to have its own existence by inaccurate consciousness affected by ignorance. This means that conventional consciousnesses, such as the visual consciousness, establish these objects. How is it that Bhavavivika himself must accept this? He must accept it insofar as that is, because the refutation of ultimate production as the predicate of the prebendum is based upon those subjects. If they did exist in reality, it would contradict that relationship between subject and predicate, page 256. Granted that he accepts things in this way, what does that entail? Those subjects, form, etc., that neither exist in reality nor are reality itself, cannot be considered objects found by non-mistaken consciousness. Hence, they are found by conventional consciousness or subjects that apprehend the false objects. And thus, those consciousnesses are mistaken, that is, unaffected by ignorance. Therefore, the mistaken consciousness and objects that appear to mistaken consciousnesses are not found by non-mistaken consciousness. This is because the inaccurate mistaken consciousness and the accurate non-mistaken consciousnesses are different, which is to say that each engages its object by excluding the object of the other. This is the meaning of the Chandrakirti statement that inaccurate and accurate consciousnesses are different. The explanation of that occurs in the passage. Therefore, when an inaccurate, etc., are in non-existent insofar as they are merely conventional, their inaccurate refers to a conventional consciousness that is affected by ignorance, such as the visual consciousness. That such consciousness takes what is non-existent as existent refers to the fact that whilst form, sound, etc., have no essential or intrinsic character, the sensory consciousnesses apprehend them as having such a character. The way that non-conceptual consciousness apprehend their objects is in terms of mere appearance, and that is why form and such appear to sensory consciousness to exist by way of their intrinsic character. The world, it does not perceive, even to the slightest degree, an object that exists, mean that because intrinsic character appears, despite its non-existence, there is no way for those consciousness to establish even the slightest object that exists by way of its intrinsic character. The falling hair is an example of an object that does not exist by way of its intrinsic character, yet appears as though it did. These sentences mean that the sensory consciousness to which things such as form and sound appear are mistaken and are therefore suited to attest that an object exists by way of its intrinsic character. The passage that begins, when an accurate consciousness indicates that non-mistaken consciousness does not at all apprehend form, sound, as such. The word accurate refers to non-mistaken consciousness, noble beings who perceive reality as such, possess such consciousness, and no one else. That non-mistaken consciousness does not reify what is unreal. This means that it does not reify or take as existing such things as form and sound, which cannot be final reality. For example, it is like the fact that the visual consciousness of someone without eye does not see an image of falling hair. In that same sentence, the phrase, insofar as they are merely conventional, refers to false objects like form and sound, non-existent, means non-existing by way of intrinsic nature. Such conventional objects are not established even in part by non-mistaken consciousness, that is, by consciousness that have final reality as their objects. This is because non-mistaken consciousness do not see such conventional objects. On these points, Chandrakirti cites a proof text by Nagarjuna, the protector, if sensory perception and so forth. This supporting citation states that the four direct, inferential, scriptural, and analogical valid cognition, sensory perception, and so forth, do not at all establish an object that exists by way of its intrinsic character. The sentence that begins, since inaccurate and accurate, summarizes the point Chandrakirti has already explained. The sentence, so how could the conventional I, as the subject of syllogism, exist, is not claiming that subjects such as the conventional I are non-existent. Instead, as explained above, it means that a form that exists by way of its intrinsic character or is established by non-mistaken perception cannot be the subject of the syllogism, even conventionally. The meaning of therefore, since, is that when both the proponents of the essential, so long as one accepts even conventional terms, that things have intrinsic character. Page 258. The word non-mistaken, the final paragraph on page 258. Page 259, here the term intrinsic character is not used as the logicians use it, simply to mean something that performs a function. Instead, as previously explained, it refers to something's own intrinsic nature, which any functioning thing or non-functioning thing is believed to have. That is why the advocates of intrinsic nature claim that even in an inference that comprehends a non-thing is not mistaken regarding conceived object that has such an intrinsic nature. Every consciousness that is non-mistaken with respect to such an intrinsic nature must also be non-mistaken with respect to its appearing object and its conceived objects. And since this makes such a consciousness non-mistaken with respect to ultimate reality itself, our own system does not hold that such valid cognition establishes such establish the subject, etc. However, we do not deny that there are, in the mind stream of both parties, conventional valid cognitions that perceive things like eyes and forms. In fact, even in the mind stream of the opponent, the forms, etc. Page 259, final paragraph. Living beings who have not developed within their mind streams the view that knows the absence of intrinsic nature possess the third and first modes of apprehension, that is, the apprehension of mere existence and the apprehension of true existence. But they lack the apprehension of things as like essenceless illusions. It is completely wrong to claim that before living beings find the view that phenomena are like illusion, any conception they have of something as existing is a conception of true existence. This is something that I have already explained above in the section that discusses conventional valid cognition and in the section in which I differentiate the four, intrinsic existence, lack of intrinsic existence, existence and non-existence. Suppose that this were not the case. That is, suppose that those who have not yet understood the view that there is no intrinsic nature did apprehend everything as truly existent whenever they thought of any conventional thing. There would ensue a complete logical breakdown of the need for Madhyamakas to accept conventionally the objects that are posited by the world's ordinary conventional consciousnesses, insofar as those consciousnesses are not affected by the previously explained circumstances that cause error. Therefore, since there would be no way to distinguish the ontological status of conventional objects from the ontological status of a putative divine creator, this erroneous view would be a great impediment to understanding the meaning of the Madhyamaka. There are many who show indications of having misunderstood emptiness in this way. They initially engage in many virtuous activities that require conceptual thought. But to 61, there are Democrats such as the Master Babavika who accept that conventional phenomena have essential or intrinsic character. The conventional existence of essential or intrinsic character is their reason for accepting autonomous reason in their own system. So those who, therefore, in their substantive system, so those who accept that things have intrinsic nature are saying this, therefore there's something unimpaired sensory perception to which essential intrinsic nature appears are conventionally non-mistaken with respect to the appearing objects. The conceptual consciousness that conceives of a subject such as a seedling as having that kind of nature is also non-mistaken with respect to its conceived object. Otherwise, if they accepted that those consciousnesses are mistaken, then what valid cognition would establish the elements of a syllogism as appearing in common for both their system and that of the essentialists? If the sensory perception to which essential nature appears established the implement of syllogism for the essentialists, even though, as Chandrakirti holds, there is no intrinsic nature, such as the essentialist character that appears, then how can one use an autonomous reason? For one would have already proven the absence of intrinsic nature of the essentialist while establishing the subject. Opponent. Let the essentialist opponent establish the subject as strong as they may. It is not necessary for the subject as strong to be established as appearing in common to both the Madhyamakas and to them. Reply, but that is something that Bhavaviveka himself does not accept, nor is it correct for him to do so. For if he did, it would entail that all probative reasons and syllogisms are offered simply in terms of what the other party accepts, and that would make him a follower of the Prasangikas. There are Yogacara Savatantrikas masters like the Sarantarakshita who assert that external objects do not exist conventionally, however, like those Chittamatrins who are Satyakaravadins. They assert that blue and such conventionally exist in the substance of consciousness. Therefore, since the sensory consciousness to which blue, etc., appear, do have a view of them, apprehending them as existing by way of their intrinsic character, Sandarachita and others do not concede that the sensory consciousness is mistaken in their view of blue itself. When hidden objects, please keep reading, page 262.
Page number 262, second paragraph. As I have already explained, they believe that an object that exists by way of its intrinsic character does appear and must objectively exist as it appears. This being the case, there can be no non-mistaken perception that establishes anything as appearing in common both to them and to Madhyamikas, who maintain that there is no essential or intrinsic nature. Second outline. Demonstrating that reason also is not established. Chandrakirti's clear words indicate this in the passage that shows the same method that was used to show that the position is defective insofar as its basis not established should be used to show that defect that the reason because it exists is also not established. Previously, Chandrakirti explained that because there is no valid cognition that establishes a commonly appearing subject for the systems of both parties, the proponents and the opponents of the emptiness of essential or intrinsic existence, the theses or problem which combine the autonomous agreement subject, visible from its predicate, is not produced from itself, also does not exist. Page number 263. The clear word says this is so, for this logician himself accepts implicitly the points we have just made. How so? Another body offers him this proof, the consciousness that serves to bring about the internal sensory faculties, such are existent without qualification. This is the case because the Tathagata said there. For whatever Tathagata has said is accurate, as in the case of his teaching that Nirvana is peace. What do you believe the import of the reason to be? Is it that such causes exist because the Tathagata has said so in terms of conventional? Or is it because he had said so in terms of ultimate? If it is true, because he said this in terms of conventional, the import of the reason would be established for you. If you take it that Buddha made this statement in terms of ultimate, since neither the problem of not what proves it are established in terms of ultimate, the reason would not be established and will in fact contradict the thesis. This is how strict is the fall in that proof. Since it is through such considerations that he asserts that the reason is not established, the reason and so forth are not established for him in any argument that possesses a refined thing as reason, and hence all probative arguments will fall apart. Some Tibetans who consider themselves followers of Chandrakriti interpret this passage in the following way. Baba Viveka's Blaze of Reasons and other Sautantrika texts put forward the following syllogism. Earth is not ultimate of nature of solitary because it is an element like wind. They say that Chandrakriti refutes this approach as follows. If you possess it because it is an element ultimately as a reason, then it is not established for you. If you possess it because it is an element conventional as a reason, then it is not established for the opponent, the essentialist. If this argument does not induce you to accept that your own reason is not established, then you contradict your belief that the reason that is not established from either of these two points of view must be a reason that is not established. And there are those who say that Baba Viveka is refuted because when he states just being an element as a reason without any specification, recent knowledge does not establish it. But refutation does not proceed in this way. This is not at all proper of the clear roads, nor does accept any such thing. Hence, these individuals misrepresent both systems. Well, then how is the passage to be interpreted? In the passage that states, for this logician himself accepts implicitly the points we have just made. The phrase, the points we have just made, refers to the previously explained method for showing that the subject is not established, and also to the application of that method to the reason. For the text states this in the immediately preceding passage. This being the case, it follows that valid cognitions such as perceptions that establish the subject and reason are inevitably either mistaken or non-mistaken. If you posit an object formed by an unmistaken consciousness as a reason or as another part of the syllogism, then it will not be established for the essentialist. If you posit an object formed by a non-mistaken consciousness in that role, our own valid cognitions will not establish it. Therefore, autonomous reasons and subjects are not established. This is what we explained above, and it is the meaning of Chandrakriti's phrase, the points we have just met. Baba Viveka himself asserts that this kind of analysis leads to positing that a syllogism reasons is not established. To show how Baba Viveka asserts this, Chandrakriti cites Baba Viveka's analysis in terms of two truths of his opponent's reason, because the Tathagata said so. Contrary to the misinterpretation proposed above, that analysis is not at all meant as an analysis of whether the state of reason is because the Tathagata has said so conventionally or because the Tathagata has said so ultimately. Why, as explained above, the Baba Viveka's position that you must posit the subject without qualifying it either is real or unreal, just as Baba Viveka accepts that subjects such as such qualification would not be established for one or the other of the parties. Like he likewise accepts that such is the case for the reason, the example, and so forth. Therefore, if Baba Viveka had faulted the example and Baba Viveka had faulted the essentialist reason by applying qualifications such as conventionally and ultimately, his argument would be a gross self-contradiction. How could this consummate scholar make such an error? Page number 265, second paragraph. You may interpret Baba Viveka's question to his opponent as, when you say, because it is an element, which of the two truths is the element that is posited as the reason? This interpretation is correct in that it is just like what we have explained above. However, if you claim that Baba Viveka is asking in terms of which of the two truths is the element stated as the reason, then you completely misunderstand the position of the opponent. If that is what Baba Viveka meant, then how could he say this to his opponent of the two truths, which is it? If the ultimate, then it is not established for us. And yet, if conventional, it is not established for the other party. If it were possible to claim that Baba Viveka's analysis refers to things existing ultimately and conventionally, then since the internal sensory sources that he posits as subjects in his singularism refuting ultimate production exist conventionally, that subject would not be established for those essentialist opponents. Well, then how can Chandrakriti claim that Baba Viveka accepts these points we have just met through his use of two truths to analyze the reason given by essentialists? I shall explain. Here, Chandrakriti is of the opinion that what is found by a non-mistaken consciousness is the ultimate, and what is found by a mistaken consciousness is the conventional. This being the case, the question, which of the two truths is it, is conceived of as a question regarding which of the two consciousness it is that find the reason. It has to be one of these two options. For if the object stated as a reason is neither the conventional nor the ultimate, then that reason cannot be established. So if the object stated as a reason is not an object found by either a non-mistaken or a mistaken consciousness, then the object stated as a reason cannot be established. Indeed, the reasons are parallel. Chandrakriti states this Baba Viveka himself accepts this reason because of existing is not established. But he does not say that Baba Viveka accepts this explicitly. That is why Chandrakriti in his clear words specifies a refined thing when it says in any argument that posits a refined thing as a reason. The master Baba Viveka believes that of the reasons he posits, some are directly established by non-mistaken perception, while others are not, but are proofs that finally derive from non-mistaken perception. This master reviewed this to prove that it is incorrect to accept objects that exist by way of the intrinsic character. The earlier citation from the clear words, Madhyamikas do not accept others' position, quotes passages such as refutation of objects, objection stanza that begins, perception and so forth. By drawing from such situation the conclusion that there are no valid cognition that perceive intrinsic character, Chandrakriti aims to prove this point to the partisans of Master Baba Viveka's system. We're in page number 269, chapter number 21. Our critic of Sautantrika does not hurt our own arguments. So, again, we are on page number 269. This is our procedure for refuting misconceptions by stating a singularism based on what others accept. As this is very important, I will explain it in detail. The phrase that is established for them at the end of that passage does not mean that we do not in our system accept the subject, the I, the example, the pot, the reason that it does not see itself, and the predicated quality that it does not see blue, etc. Nor does it mean that reason, provision, and so forth are established only for the opponent since they are simply what others assert. What does it mean? Even though we do accept this four in our own system, our system does not have even conventionally a valid cognition that establishes them and that understands its objects as existing essentially. What does it mean? Even though we do accept this four in our system does not have even conventionally a valid cognition that establishes them and that understand this object as existing essentially. For proponents of intrinsic existence, the establishment of the subject, etc., definitely depends upon those being established by this kind of valid cognition. Therefore, there is no valid cognition which understands its object as existing essentially that can establish a common appearance of the subject, etc., for both parties. Hence, they are said not to be established for both parties. They are said to be based on what is accepted by or established for others. Thank you. Well, page number 271. The reply. This should be explained as in Buddhapali, this commentary on the fundamental treatise. For example, through association with water, earth is perceived to be wet. Through association with fire, water is perceived as hot. And through association with jasmine flowers, a cloth is perceived as fragrant. We see that those perceptions of earth is wet, etc., are contingent upon perceptions of wetness, heat, and fragrance in water, fire, and jasmine flowers, respectively. This is something that you yourself accept. Likewise, if things are some essential or intrinsic nature, you would have to perceive that intrinsic nature in regard to thing itself. Sorry, we are in page number 270. The objection, you claim to expose a contradiction between the opponent's assertion that eye does not see itself and the opponent's assertion that the eye is seeing blue and such has an essential or intrinsic nature. But what kind of cognition understands a contradiction? If it is a valid cognition that establishes contradiction, it will have to establish it for other parties. So it will not be based on that what others accept. If you perceive the contradiction simply by its being asserted. Valid cognition, so to see at a thing, so the seeing itself, if it exists from its own intrinsic nature, then we cannot differentiate between the object of seeing and the consciousness which looks at it. Page number 270, the final paragraph. If it is possible to teach that valid cognition to the opponents and for them to then ascertain the contradiction, why is it necessary to rely on what they accept? Page number 271. As the essential sees it, for something to be a valid cognition that proves the contradiction, it must understand an essentially existent object. But how can we prove the contradiction by accepting for our own part something that does not exist? Once we have shown them that there is no contradiction in positing something as a valid cognition, even though its object lacks essential or intrinsic nature, this type of valid cognition will prove it to them. They will then have found the view that knows the phenomena lack intrinsic nature, so at that point there will be no need to prove to them that if something does not see itself, this contradicts its seeing essentially. Therefore, if you want to understand Chandrakriti system, you should analyze these points in detail and penetrate their meaning. We're in the final paragraph. Using examples that are acceptable and familiar to his opponents, he leads them to certainty about the provision and counter-provision and then applies them to the case at hand. If the eye had some seeing essence, then its sight of itself should be noticed first. Only then would it be possible to notice that it sees such things as forms and to notice that it sees the component of form within composite things. But since the eye does not see itself, it does not see other things. This is how we demonstrate the provision using what others accept. But since the eye does not see itself, it does not see other things. This is how we demonstrate the provision using what others accept. Also, Aryadeva's 400 stanza states, if the nature of all things first appear within the things themselves, then why should the eye not also apprehend itself? Fire burns other things, even though it does not burn itself. Likewise, it is not contradictory for the eye to see other things, even though it does not see itself. We do not broadly refute that fire burns fuel or that the eye merely sees forms. Instead, we refute that eye essentially sees other things. As this is so, your example will have to be that fire essentially burns fuel. Consequently, your example is wrong, just as what you are trying to prove is wrong. If fire and both fuel had essential or intrinsic nature, then they will have to be either of one nature or of different natures. So which is it? If they are of one nature, then fire will burn itself. And also, how could fire be burning the agent and the fuel, the object that is burnt? Suppose that you insist that they could be, if someone were to argue that fire is the burnt object and the fuel is the burning agent, what rebuttal could you give? If they have something natural, fire could be present even without fuel, just as oxen can't be present without horses. As Aryadeva's 400 stanza states, fire burns something that is hot. If something is not hot, how can it be burning? Therefore, there is nothing called fuel apart from fire, and except for that fuel, how there can be no fire. If you claim that burning has essential or intrinsic nature, it follows that what does not burn itself cannot burn other things. Likewise, if you claim that eye has seeing as its intrinsic nature, you have to accept that if it does not see itself, it cannot see other things. Hence, the above faults do not birch. When one sees some critics of the belief in intrinsic nature, one gives up the tenets that conceive of existence of essential or intrinsic nature. One can then understand that objects and agents are tenable in the absence of intrinsic nature. Hence, one distinguishes the absence of intrinsic existence from non-existence. Consequently, one also distinguishes intrinsic existence from existence, so one knows that valid cognitions that have no intrinsic nature comprehend objects that have no intrinsic nature, and so forth. Page number 273. The valid cognitions that know that fire and fuel lack intrinsic nature cannot be perceptions, and thus you have to believe that they are inferences. If that is so, what reasoning are they based upon? If things like fire and fuel have intrinsic nature, they must be either the same or different. After you have seen this, you see that a refutation of both intrinsic natures that are the same and intrinsic natures that are different must entail the absence of intrinsic nature. This fulfills the first two criteria of a correct reason. The assentiment that there is no intrinsic nature that is the same or different fulfills the third criterion, the reason's presence in the subject. Therefore, it is reason that fulfills the three criteria for being a correct reason capable of inducing inferential knowledge. Based on that reason, one ascertains that fire and fuel lack intrinsic nature. This ascertainment is an inference. In the case of previously opposed synonyms based on what others accept, you should understand that we use the same method to develop the three criteria and corresponding inference. In reductio form, the argument works as follows. If fire and fuel have intrinsic nature, they would have to be either the same or different, and if they are the same, then fire will burn itself, and so forth. This form uses something that the other party accepts as a reason, drawing implications contrary to the other party's beliefs. This example also allows you to understand how to construct other reductio arguments. So as long as these opponents do not give up their essentialist tenets, they continue to believe that valid cognitions establish the referent objects of the various parts of a syllogism in reliance upon the knowledge of things that essentially exist. The moment that they know with valid cognition the essencelessness of many things, they give up their essentialist tenets, the clear word states. Still, does the refutation of the essentialist use an inference in which the subject, etc., are inferentially established for at least one of the two parties, even if not for both? Yes, it uses a reasoning that is established for the essentialists themselves and not one that is established for the third party. For that is what is seen in the world. In the world, sometimes who wins and who loses a dispute is decided through the testimony of a witness whom both parties accept as reliable. Sometimes, however, this may be decided using only their own testimony without the need for someone else's testimony to determine who wins and who loses. This is true as much in the realm of philosophical reasoning as it is in the world, for it is only worldly convention that is at stake in philosophical treatises. We are on page number 276, chapter number 22, Analyzing a Chariot. How to use that procedure to generate the right philosophical view within your mind stream. This third section describes how to develop the right philosophical view in your mind stream using a Prasangika procedure. Within this section, there are three parts. How to determine that there are no self in the person has three parts. Actually, determining that self lacks intrinsic existence, this is two parts. Giving the example, a sutra cited in Chandrakriti's explanation of the middle way. Commentary says, self is a demonic mind, you have wrong view. These composite aggregates are empty, there is no living being in them. Just as one speaks of a chariot, so those tenets and philosophical scholars who accept the phenomenon objects as intrinsically existing, so it has been refuted to a large extent in the fundamental supplement to the Madhyamika text by Chandrakriti. And it's also evident in the sutras that the form itself is not devoid of the emptiness, as the form itself is empty. So when we repeat phrases that the form is empty, and empty is also the nature of form, if the object has an existence but is from nature or is from innately existent, and so the object to be negated here, if that object itself lacks the inherent existence, then that is the establishment of emptiness. So this proves that when we speak about the form itself is being devoid of intrinsic existence, or the form itself is empty. As it is stated in by Chandrakriti, as it has been established by seven reasonings, that there is no intrinsic reality, and all the phenomena and persons are being established by their parts. Page number 278, continue. Self is a demonic mind. You have a wrong view. These composite aggregates are empty. There is no living being in them. Just as one speaks of a chariot, independence upon collections of parts, so we use the convention living being, independence upon the aggregates. Self is a demonic mind, I think, is also existing in Pali texts. So when we refer to the self, the mere denomination of self is actually not to be refuted. But as it appears to our mind, the self is something existent, as a self-sufficient existence. So that kind of self is to be refuted. And such a kind of self is the basis of all the wrong view. And these composite aggregates are empty, the third line. So these composite aggregates of the body and abundant, there is no self which we can find. Then the fourth standard says there is no living being in them. So if there is, in that case, and if there is no person or person that we can find, but then it says that, of course, there is a person, but it exists with dependence upon the parts and the body. And due to the different symbols and between male and female, so we differentiate between the person as being a male or a female. And of course, due to the different body parts, the differentiate, we make distinction between the person as a wise, a scholar, or a fool. So it shows very clearly that there is not a self which is completely different from the body or the parts. But then within the body or its parts, if we are trying to find a self, then of course in that case we have to find, or we have to point to the consciousness itself as a self. But then again, the consciousness itself is not something to be found at all times, especially during when we faint, or during the time of death, or during deep sleep, it cannot be ascertained. So in that case, we cannot point to the consciousness as also an example of self. Taking as an example the imputation of a chariot in dependence upon its parts, such as its wheels, the Buddha states that the self or living being is also imputed in dependence upon the aggregates. Therefore, I will first explain the example of the chariot. The explanation of the example is forward, showing that the chariot exists impurely without intrinsic existence. Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way says, a chariot is neither asserted to be other than its parts, nor to be non-other. It does not possess them. It does not depend on the parts, and the parts do not depend on them. It is neither the mere collection of the parts, nor is it their ship. So if you find the chariot through the seven kinds of reasoning, then there is not a single part from which you can find the complete chariot. Thus, he says that just as a chariot is a mere imputation, since it does not exist in these seven ways, one with its parts different from its parts, etc., so it is also for the self and aggregates. If the chariot has an essential or intrinsic nature, it undoubtedly will be established by reason knowledge that analyzes whether it exists intrinsically in any of the seven ways. However, since it is not established by such knowledge in any of the seven ways, it does not intrinsically exist. The parts of a chariot are the axle, the wheels, the nails, etc. The chariot is not intrinsically one with those parts. If it were one, there will be fallacies such as the following: just as the parts are plural, so the chariot will also be many; just as the chariot is single, so the part will also be single. Agent and object will be the same. Nor is a chariot intrinsically separate from its part, because if it were, it would be seen separately apart from them like pot and cloth, yet it is not. Also, there will be no reason to impute in relation to these parts. Two of the positions involve positing a chariot and its parts as basis and dependent. A chariot is not the basis for its parts like a bowl holding yogurt, or nor does it rest in its parts like Devadatta in a tent, because such relationships could be demonstrated only if a chariot and its part were essentially separate, but they are not. Here we do not refute mere mutual existence, but we refute a basis and dependent that exists by way of intrinsic character. Even the two examples just mentioned refer to situations in which the other party accepts that there are intrinsically characterized basis and dependents. All similar cases should be understood in this way. The possibility of possession is also untenable. If you hold that a chariot possesses its parts, just as Devadatta possesses oxen, that is, an object other than himself, then just as the oxen and Devadatta are seen separately, a chariot and its parts should likewise be seen separately, yet they are not. Thus, there is no such possession. It is also unreasonable that a chariot should possess its parts, just as Devadatta possesses his ear, because we are now refuting intrinsic difference. For things that exist essentially, this type of position will involve intrinsic oneness, and we already refuted that. Again, we do not refute the conventional existence of Devadatta merely having an air, and the same applies to the chariot. Thus, we refute intrinsically characterized position. We are in the second paragraph. There are two points to be made here. It is contrary to reason. A chariot will exist even in a complete collection of separated parts, wheels and such, lying in pieces, since the mere collection of parts is a chariot. It contradicts their assertions. Buddhist essentialists assert that there are no wholes, but only mere groups of parts. If there is so, even parts would not exist, because that which is parts, that is wholes, would not exist. Therefore, even mere groups of parts would not exist. The collection of parts could not be a chariot. The assertions of Master Chandrakriti make it unnecessary to add qualification to the refutation of chariots being the mere collection of its parts. This is because the collection is the basis of imputation of the chariot, for he says that since the collection of aggregates is the basis to which self is imputed, it cannot be the self. I do not claim that mere collection of the parts is chariot. Rather, I posit as chariot the distinctive shape of the parts when they are arranged. In saying this, you contradict your own assertions, as explained above, since you asserted what is parts does not exist, parts also will not exist. Therefore, it is unreasonable to posit the mere shape of the parts is chariot. The word also in the verse just cited means that it is not just a mere collection that cannot be chariot. Furthermore, if you say that such a shape is a chariot, then is a chariot the shape of individual parts or the shape of a collection? If the former, is it a shape not different from the shape of the parts prior to their being assembled, or is it a shape unlike their shape prior to the assembly? Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way points out the fallacy in the first position. If you say that the shape that each part already had is what we know as a chariot, then just as there is no chariot when the parts are unassembled, so it is also when they are assembled. Also, the shapes of the wheels and such as no futures after assembly, unlike those they had prior to assembly. Therefore, just as there is no chariot when the parts are separate, there is no chariot when they are assembled. Suppose that the chariot is some other shape apart from that of the wheels and such prior to assembly, which appears later when they are assembled and is unlike the shape of those earlier parts. Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way states this fallacy. If now, while the chariot itself is here, there were different shapes in the wheels and such, then it would be evident, but it is not. Therefore, the mere shape is not a chariot. If there is something different, more dissimilar features between the shape of the wheels, axle, and such before assembly and their shape after assembly, then this would have to be evident. But no matter how you look, you do not observe such. Hence, it is not reasonable for some shape of the parts after assembly, unlike the shape of the parts prior to assembly, to be the chariot. I do not claim that individual shapes of the individual parts are a chariot. I consider the general shape of the collection of the parts to be a chariot. Chandrakirti's commentary on the middle way states this fallacy. According to you, collections do not exist at all, so the shape cannot be that of the collection of parts. How could you see a chariot in the shape of something that does not exist at all? We are on page number 283. We hold that what is round bellied, long neck, and so forth is a pod. But we do not accept that the round bellied shape is a pod. Otherwise, we would have to agree that bellies and necks are also pods. Eliminating objections to that, essential is objection. When you use reason to analyze the question of intrinsic nature, searching for the chariot in the seven ways just as explained, and you do not find it, then the chariot must be exist. Yet if this were so, then conventional designations of chariot would not be met in the world. This is not enable witness expressions such as fetch a chariot, buy a chariot, and make a chariot. Therefore, things such as chariot do exist. Chandrakirti's explanation of the middle way commentary shows that this fallacy falls only to you essential is not us. First, if it were as you say, then worldly conventions such as fetch a chariot could not exist. For when you posit things as existing, you use reasoned analysis to search so as to see whether they have intrinsic nature. Yet when you sought by such reasoning, the chariot is not found in any of the seven ways. Since you advance no other method for established things, chariots will be non-existent. It seems that nowadays some who claim to advocate the meaning of Madhyamaka put forward as Madhyamaka system, an argument made by advocates of true existence. When reasoning searches to see whether a chariot has intrinsic nature and fails to find a chariot, then a chariot does not exist. An undeniable fall of such assertion is that they make it impossible to give any presentation of conventional phenomena. The following passage from Chandrakirti's commentary on middle way shows how our position does not have this problem. This chariot is not established in the seven ways, either in reality or for the world. Yet without analysis, just for the world, it is imputed independence about its parts. The meaning of this is as follows. When reasoning searches to see whether the chariot intrinsically exists, it is not found in any of the seven ways. This is the case in terms of both of the two truths. But when reason fails to find it in those seven ways, does this refute the chariot? How can it? How could it? Reasoning that analyzes whether things intrinsically exist does not establish the assertion of the chariot. Rather, leaving reason analysis aside, it is established by a mere unimpure, ordinary, conventional, that is worldly consciousness. Therefore, the way a chariot is posited is that it is established as existing imputedly. It is imputed in dependence upon its parts. When a yogi analyzes in this way, reason does not find a chariot, hence the chariot does not exist essentially or intrinsically. However, it parts do exist intrinsically. You are searching for threads in the ashes of incarnated cloud, it is ridiculous if the whole does not exist, neither to the past, as Chandrakirti's commentary on the middle way says. When a chariot itself does not exist, neither the whole nor its part exists. Thus the whole does not exist, this part also do not exist. This is untenable because when the chariot is destroyed, the collection of the parts, wheels and such are still evident. No. For only those who have seen the chariot before will think, these wheels and so forth are those of a chariot. Others will not think that. When the chariot is destroyed, the wheels and such are not associated with the chariot, and thus they are not parts of a chariot. Therefore, neither the chariot as a whole nor the parts of the chariot exist at that time. At that point, in terms of chariot, neither the whole nor part exists. However, the wheels, etc., are wholes in relation to their components, and these components are their parts. Hence, you cannot posit parts without a whole. Outline number 3, how to establish the chariot under various names. Chandrakriti's explanation of the middle way commentary says, our position very clearly establishes the conventional designation of a chariot in terms of what is familiar to the world, what is more. You should also assert any of the chariot's various names in terms of what is familiar to the world without analysis. It is thus, that same chariot is known as a whole, as a composite, and as an agent. Living beings are established as appropriators of 5 aggregates. In relation to parts and components such as wheels, a chariot is established as a referent of the conventions whole and composite. Likewise, it is designated with the nominal convention agent with reference to its activity of appropriating wheels, etc., and with nominal conventional appropriator in relation to appropriate parts. The fourth outline, the advantage that you find the view quickly by using the example. Chandrakriti's explanation of middle way commentary says, these worldly conventionalities do not exist when analyzed in that way, but exist only through being taken for granted without being subject to scrutiny. Therefore, when yogis analyze these worldly conventionalities through this very process, they will very quickly fathom the depths of reality. So, when we find the reality of the phenomena through different reasonings, so since it cannot be ascertained through this reasoning, this shows or this proves that phenomena does not have a reality existent. This means that it is through such an analysis of the chariot that you quickly fathom the deepest meaning of reality, that there is no intrinsic nature. Thus, it is evident that there is a very crucial point. Yogis who in this way analyze how things exist will develop certainty, thinking, if this chariot exists intrinsically, then when I search the reasoning that looks to see whether it exists intrinsically in any of the 7 ways, seem different and so forth, I should undoubtedly find it in one of the 7 ways, yet I do not find it in any of those 7 ways. It is apparent that despite its not being found, I cannot refute the convention of the chariot. Still, chariot is imputed only by way of the mind's eye being corrupted by flimsy ignorance. It is not intrinsically existent. Such yogis easily enter into reality. Third paragraph. In brief, there are 3 advantages to presenting this topic as explainable. Burning with chariot, the advantage is that it is easy to refute the externalist view that superimposes intrinsic existence on phenomena. The advantage that it is easy to refute the nihilistic view that dependent arising is invalid in the absence of intrinsic nature. And the yogi's investigative process, which establishes the first 2 advantages by carrying out analysis in just such a manner. To elaborate on these 3, when you use a highly condensed method of refuting intrinsic nature, refuting such same and different, it is difficult to understand. It again becomes difficult when there are too many alternatives. Thus, the sevenfold analysis is quite appropriate. In that you refute an object of negation with an added qualification during the initial refutation, you refute intrinsic existence without damaging the conventional existence of actions and agents. After you have developed certainty that pervaded intrinsic existence does not extend beyond the pervader, the 7 ways such as one and different, you then show that each of those 7 is contradicted. When you determine that any one of those 7 is contradicted, this negates the pervader. After you have done this once, you then repeatedly develop the decisive certainty that there is no intrinsic existence. After that, when you see that you cannot refute it, the convention of the chariot, even though there is no intrinsic existence, you think, oh, it is amazing how the magicians of karma and afflictions conjure up this illusion, such as chariot. Each arises without even the slightest confusion from its own causes and conditions, which lacks even the slightest trace of essentials or intrinsic existence. You will be certain that dependent arising means that things are not intrinsically produced. His Holiness refers to this dependent arising as the dependent arising based on cause and effect. As Chandrakriti's commentary on the 400 stanza says, pots and such do not exist under the fivefold analysis as to whether they are same as their causes or other than their causes. Nevertheless, through Tibetan invitation, they can do things that hold or scoop honey or water or milk. Is this not wonderful? And what lacks intrinsic existence and yet is evident is empty of intrinsic existence, like the circle of a whirling firebrand. We are on page number 290, chapter number 23. The person lacks intrinsic nature, page number 290. The refutation of the position that self is one with aggregates. In the general case, we see in the world that when a phenomenon is mentally classified as accompanied, it is precluded from being unaccompanied. And when it is classified as unaccompanied, it is precluded from being unaccompanied. In general, therefore, same and different, as well as single and plural, eliminate any further alternative because unaccompanied and accompanied are respectively single and plural. When you resolve that in general, something must be either one or not one, then you will also resolve that for the particular case of what exists essentially, it must be either essentially one or essentially different. Second last paragraph, fundamental treatise also makes this point. If there is no self except for the appropriate aggregates, the appropriate aggregates are the self. In that case, the self that proposes does not exist. If the person and aggregates were intrinsically one, then just as one person has many aggregates, one person would also have many selves. Or just as there is no more than one self, there would also be one aggregate. These are the fallacies given in Chandrakriti's commentary on the Middle Way. Page number 291. If the aggregates were the self, then since there are many aggregates, the self will also be many. Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise states, if the aggregates were the self, then the self will be subject to production and disintegration. And what is appropriated is not the self. They arise and disintegrate. You should understand that what is appropriated here refers to aggregates. What fallacy is there in holding that the self is subject to momentary production and disintegration? Chandrakriti's commentary on the Middle Way and explanation of the Middle Way commentary gives three fallacies in this position. Recollection of the past lives would be untenable. Actions done will perish, and you will encounter the effects of actions that you did not do. To elaborate, if the self arose and disintegrated moment by moment, then since the self will be essentially arising and disintegrating, former and later selves will be distinct in their intrinsic character. In that case, the Buddha will not have said, in that life at the time I was King Madhir, because the king of the self of the King Manda and the self of the teacher will be distinct in their intrinsic character. For example, it will be like Devadatta trying to recall his past lives and mistakenly remembering, I become Yashnadatta. Otherwise, if you argue that it is not contradictory for earlier experience to be remembered by a later self despite the former and later selves being different in their intrinsic character, then you have to explain why this situation is different from Yashnadatta's not remembering Devadatta's experience. However, you cannot find a rationale for this. This is similar to the argument that refutes production from other. To the assertion that seed and seedling exist essentially or intrinsically, yet differ as cause and effect, we reply, if it were possible for such intrinsically different phenomena to be cause and effect, then even a flame will produce darkness. This does not wipe out the assertion that seed and seedling are mere different. Did that sutra teach that the teacher and mandat are one? That passage refutes the otherness of continuum, but does not teach that they are one. According to Chandrakriti, this is why sutra ends by saying, do you think that person in that lifetime was someone else? Do not look at it that way. We are on the final paragraph. Actions done will perish, page number 292. Second, actions done will perish. Some claim that if the self was in each moment arising and disintegrating by way of its own intrinsic character, then later selves will still enjoy the effects of the actions of earlier selves. I refute this assertion in below, so here I argue that if this were the case, there would be no experience of the effects of previously accumulated karma, because the self that is the agent of an action will disintegrate prior to the experience of its effect, and there will be no other self to have such experience. Since earlier and later things are not essentially different, there is no later self that is essentially different from the former. If the effects were not experienced by earlier self, then the effects must not be experienced. Refute below the reply that such former and later selves are in the same continuum. Hence, you cannot escape the fallacy that actions that are performed will perish. We are on page number 293. As Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way states, prior to nirvana, there will be no karmic effects, because agents that arise and disintegrate in the very moment of an action would not exist to experience its effect. Each person will get what others accumulated. Chandrakriti mentions three other fallacies, but they seem to refute only the assertions of other Buddhists. Since I am advancing a general refutation, I will not give them here. Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise also gives those two arguments. If this self were different from that of an earlier life, it will arise even without other having existed. Likewise, that earlier self could remain there in that life without the self dying. This self could be born. There will be absurd consequences such as the severing of the continuum with the wasting of actions and each person experiencing the effects of actions performed by others. This gives the two fallacies that Chandrakriti uses, the wasting of actions and the experiencing of the effects of actions performed by others. The phrase, if this self is different, means if the self of an earlier lifetime and the present self are essentially different. If this were the case, then since a present self would not in any way rely upon the self of the earlier life, it will arise without depending upon the former self. Also, just as a cloth does not disintegrate when a pot is created, the former self will remain without disintegrating when the later self was born. We could be born here in this life without dying in our lives. This is what the passage means. When page number 294, as Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way states, if you claim that there is no fallacy in a continuum that exists in reality, I already explained the fallacies of such a continuum when I analyzed this above. As to how it was analyzed, the same text states, because the phenomena associated with Maitreya and Ubhagupta are different, they are not included in one continuum. It is not reasonable that what is distinct in its intrinsic character should be included in a single continuum. If phenomena are distinct in their intrinsic character, then like two different continua, they are not to be posited as a single continuum. Also, the 27th chapter of Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise says, if a human and a deity were different, it will be untenable for them to be a single continuum. In short, whatever is essentially other must be asserted to withstand analysis by reasoning that analysis the way that it exists. There is nothing, not even the slightest particle, that withstands analysis when such reasoning analysis in detail. Hence, if a later self experiences the effects of karma accumulated by an early and intrinsically different self in the same continuum, this cannot be distinguished from the completely parallel case of selves that are in different continua. You must realize that this argument applies to all such cases. Since the one who experiences in a past life and the one who remembers in a later life are not the same, the recollection of earlier experiences and the enjoyment of the effects of previously accumulated karma are untenable even in our own system, just as in the case of persons of different continua. We do not incur that fallacy, for in the systems of others who do not assert essential existence, it does not work for the experiencer and the rememberer to be in the same continuum. But in our system, it is not contradictory for them to be in the same continuum. For example, if a dove has been on the thatched roof of a house in which there is a container of yogurt, one can see its footprints there in the yogurt, even though its feet did not enter the container of yogurt. Similarly, the person of this life has gone back to the former life. Yet it is not contradictory that such a person should remember experiences there. Chandrakriti's commentary on the 400 stages states, we dispense with any notion that the causes and effects are same or different. If there is only one impermanent stream of conditioned factors brought about by their particular causes, then it is reasonable to say that the impurely existent self that appropriates that stream of factors remembers its lives. things do not exist by way of intrinsic character. It stands to reason that they encounter various conditions and are changed. Therefore, you should carefully examine the astonishing fact that things have causes that do not exist by way of the intrinsic character. Page number 295, same page, the final quotation. Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise states, if fuel were fire, then agent and object will be one. The entire process is explained for the self and appropriate aggregates on using fire and wood as analogies along with pot and cloth and so forth. Also, Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way states, it is clearly not right for the appropriated to be one with what appropriates. If it were thus, then object and agent will be the same. Thus, if the self were one with aggregates, there will be many fallacies. It will be pointless to assert a self. There will be many selves. Object and agent will be one. Actions that were performed would perish. The effects of actions not done will be encountered, and the statements by Buddha about remembering past lives will be invalid. So to not assert that the self and the aggregates are one. The refutation of the position that self is different from aggregates. The self and the aggregates are not intrinsically one, but what fallacy is there in asserting that intrinsically different? Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise states that the fallacy in this, if the self were other than aggregates, it would not have the characters of the aggregates. If the self were essentially different from the aggregates, it will not have the aggregates' characteristics of arising, remaining, and disintegrating. For example, a horse is something other than a cow. So, does not have the characters of a cow. If someone still thinks this, take from Chandrakriti's clear words, this syllogism based on what others accept. The aggregates cannot be the basis for the conventional imputation of a self and cannot be objects apprehended as a self because the self is non-composite like a flower in the sky or nirvana. If the self do not arise and disintegrate, then it will be permanent. Since there is no way to avoid the implication that the self will be permanent, it will be pointless to impute a self because, as Buddha Palita points out, it will be impossible to engage in virtue or turn away from non-virtue. Nagarjuna's fundamental treatise says, it is just not correct for the self to be other than appropriated aggregates. If it were other, it will be apprehended without the appropriated aggregates, yet it is not. And Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way says, therefore, there is no self other than aggregates, because without aggregates it is not apprehended. Non-Buddhist philosophers, not realizing their self is a mere name and yet seeing that it is untenable for it to be one with aggregates, superimpose a self which is something other than aggregates as a matter of tenet. However, ordinary conventional consciousnesses in their mind streams do not see it that way. You should repeatedly practice so as to reach solid certainty that arguments such as this contradict the existence of a self that is essentially different from the aggregates. For if you do not develop genuine certainty about the critique of the positions of one and different, then even though you may desire that person lacks intrinsic existence, it will be just an unproved proposition. Hence, you would not obtain the authentic view. Seeking to analyze whether the person exists in reality, you should analyze whether the person, if existent in reality, will be one with or different from the aggregates. If the person were one with the aggregates, then there are conclusive criticisms such as the implications that agent and object, example fire and fuel, will be one. If fire and fuel are held to be one, you must use mundane valid cognition to refute that position. A tenet that is not shared by both parties is not an effective critic. Likewise, there is argument to the position that self and aggregates are different, that if they are essentially different, then like form and mind, they would have to be seen as separate, yet they are not. This is presented in terms of non-apprehension of such a difference by ordinary consciousness. Unique tenets are not an effective critic. Page number 298, how those arguments also refute each of the remaining positions. Page number 298. Therefore, when you trace all the roots of probative and critical arguments back to their source, you arrive at the unimpaired conventional consciousnesses of the two bodies. If someone asserts something that contradicts those consciousnesses, then both bodies will see that their experience refutes it. As this is so, the system of all madhyamikas and brahmanas is not to go beyond this. How those arguments also refute each of the remaining positions. If the self and aggregates are intrinsically different, there will be two ways in which they could be basis and dependent, like yogurt in a bowl. Either the self could exist in dependence upon the aggregates, or the aggregates could exist in dependence upon the self. However, as in the explanation of the Charvaka, since they are not intrinsically different, they do not exist at basis and dependent. Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way states, the self does not intrinsically depend on the aggregates, and the aggregates do not intrinsically depend on the self. While such conceptions should be correct if they are intrinsically different, since they are not intrinsically different, those are misconceptions. The position that self possesses the aggregate is also similar to what was explained with regard to the chariot, so it should be understood accordingly. Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way states, we do not hold that self possesses the aggregate of form. Why? Since the self does not exist, position by the self is meaningless. If they are different, then it is like having cattle. If not, then it is like having form. However, the self is neither the same as nor different from the form. Having cattle is, for example, Devadatta's having oxen. Having form is, for example, Devadatta's having form. Is a mere group of aggregates the self? This is also incorrect, because the self is said to be imputed in dependence upon the five aggregates, and it is not tenable for the basis of imputation to be the object imputed. The commentary on the middle way, the Buddha's discourses, state that the self depends upon the aggregates. Therefore, a mere group of aggregates is not the self. Furthermore, Chandrakriti's commentary on the middle way and explanation of the middle way commentary state the fallacy that if a mere collection of aggregates were the self, agent and object would be one. This is because anyone who claims that self appropriates the individual aggregates must accept that it appropriates all five aggregates. Hence, it will appropriate the collection of the aggregates as well. This passage from commentary on the middle way means that the collection is the basis to which self is imputed, but is not the self. This makes it clear that you must also assert such with regard to the continuum of the aggregates. Those are not the self, rather I perceive the self as a particular shape of the collection of form and so forth. For example, when a chariot, wheels, axle and so forth are assembled. I will read Shortland of Lamrim, the experience song first. Sorry, the middle and Lamrim. Middle and Lamrim, page 249. One wishing to abandon that apprehension should seek the view of selflessness. This is true, but the reason why you need to seek the view of realizing selflessness, if you wish to abandon that ignorance, how to generate the view of realizing selflessness? The reason why you need to seek the view of realizing selflessness, if you wish to abandon that ignorance, has 4 points. It is stupid not to make an effort for pure view to arise in one's continuum, despite the wish to abandon ignorance. It is necessary to want the extension in which the ignorance explained above the two apprehensions of a self has been abandoned. It is also as it is necessary and even seems to be wanted. That being so, someone who wants to but does not put effort into understanding how apprehending a self becomes the root of cyclic existence has very dull faculties. So does someone who, despite partial insight into this, does not put effort into generating the pure view of selflessness in his continuum, having thoroughly refuted the object apprehended by the apprehension of a self with scriptures of definite meaning as well as reasoning. That is because they have lost the vital essence of the path leading to liberation and omniscience, yet they remain indifferent about it. Showing that the apprehension of a self must be abandoned has 2 points. How it is taught in the treatises, how it is taught in the sutras. This is why the glorious Dharmakriti said, without these objects being negated, they cannot possibly be abandoned. Abandoning hatred, desire and so forth, connected with false and positive qualities, is not done by not seeing these in objects, not through some external approach. When removing an external object of abandonment, such as throne, such as a thorn that pierces your skin, you can completely remove it by means of something like a needle, independently of the object caught. In this manner, being negated, you do not do it with this when getting rid of an internal mental object of abandonment. Where at the later part of page, this approach is also the most superior intention of the protector Nagarjuna. In 60 stanzas of reasoning, he says, that is the cause of all the views. Without the afflictions do not, without it, afflictions do not arise. Therefore, if you thoroughly know this, views and afflictions are thoroughly cleansed. If you wonder how this is known, by seeing dependent origination, that things born dependently are unborn. That was taught by Supreme Omniscience. He is pointing out that the apprehension of the true existence called assertion as the real things, which is the cause of all afflicted views and all other mental afflictions, is abundant through realizing the suchness of things. They are not having the inherently arisen by means of the reason of dependent arising. Page number 251. In 400 stanzas, he also says, if selflessness is seen in objects, the seat of existence will be ceased. That is, through seeing that object of observation apprehended by apprehension of a self, like the self, the root of existent ignorance is cut. Venerable Shantideva also taught, thus the emptiness of persons is thoroughly established. Therefore, since a root has been cut, all the mental afflictions do not arise at all. It is said the Noble Sutra of Tathagata Secret says, Santimati, it is like this. For example, when a tree is cut at the root, all the branches, leaves and twigs dry up. Likewise, Shantimati, when the way of the transitory collection is fully pacified, all the mental afflictions and secondary mental afflictions are fully pacified. It is saying that through cultivating the realization of the person as an emptiness, empty of inherent establishment, the view of the transitory collection is stopped. And once it is stopped, all the other mental afflictions are also stopped. On the other hand, without the object of the apprehension of a self or persons having been negated, the realization of selflessness is impossible. The sutra passage points out that the view of the transitory collection is the root of all other mental afflictions. If it were different in meaning from ignorance, it will be too discordant roots of cyclic existence, therefore it should also be understood as ignorance. In brief, when the many supreme scholars who commented on the meaning of the scriptures on the profound settled the meaning of suchness, they carried out all through analysis by means of numerous scriptures and reasoning. They did that having perceived that it is impossible to realize selflessness and emptiness without seeing that the self as apprehended by the mistaken apprehension does not exist, and without seeing that it is empty of that self. It is essential to gain certainty with regard to this. In order to abandon the apprehension of a self, it is necessary to negate its referent object, the reason for that. If you do not meditate like this on the meaning of having negated the mistaken object, which is the root of being bound in cyclic existence, even though you meditate on something else that you consider profound, it will not harm the apprehension of a self at all. This is because unless the mind enters the suchness of selflessness and emptiness, the apprehension of a self cannot possibly be stopped. And because without the object of the apprehension of a self having been negated, you may simply withdraw your mind going off to its object, but that cannot be posited as entering selflessness. This is 3 points. The existence in general of 3 ways of apprehending, the need to settle that very basis with respect to which the apprehension of true existence is mistaken, does not exist in the way it is apprehended. Third, the need to greatly cherish the realization of the way of suchness, having seen that if you stop the apprehension of the true existence, you will turn away from cyclic existence. In the root text on wisdom, it says, page number 252, with karma and kleshas spent, there is freedom. Karma and kleshas arise from conceptions. Elaborations elaborate those. They are stopped by emptiness. You need to know those stages of entering into and turning away from cyclic existence and greatly cherish the realization of the meaning of suchness. However, it will not come through a work involvement that fails to distinguish well the objects of observation. How to generate the view realizing selflessness? Page number 253. The stages of generating the 2 views of selflessness. Page So in generally, when generating the two views of selflessness, the selflessness on person and phenomena, so the selflessness on phenomena acts as a basis, and through it arises the selflessness of person. But in terms of avoiding or eliminating the two selflessness apprehending minds, then first we have to concentrate on the selflessness of selflessness of person first, and then through it we will be able to eliminate the selflessness of apprehending selflessness on objects. As for the stages in which two apprehension, page number 253, as for the stages in which the true apprehension of a self arises, apprehension of a self of phenomena generates the apprehension of a self of persons. Still, when you engage in the suchness of selflessness, so when we have an understanding of the selflessness through the logical reasoning, sometimes it appears that we might generate an understanding of selflessness on the example. So generally it is not the way to gain the correct understanding through the example. Persons are in earth or water, are in fire, wind or space, are in consciousness. If they are none of this, what could persons be other than that? Since beings are composites of six elements, they are not real, exactly like that. Each element is a composite too, and therefore is not real either. It is a stated first person and then basis. It is imputed to the elements such as earth. So I will end here. There is an important announcement here. There will be no Lamrim teachings tomorrow morning or afternoon. Tomorrow, 10th December, is the 23rd anniversary of conferment of the Nobel Peace Prize to His Holiness the Dalai Lama. In the morning only, beginning 9 a.m., in the courtyard of Debung Losaneng, there will be speeches by His Holiness and by Indian and Tibetan representatives. An award will be presented to His Holiness by the Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism in recognition of his extraordinary contribution to humanity. The program will be translated, so everyone is welcome to attend. I repeat the announcement once again. There will be no Lamrim teachings tomorrow morning or afternoon. Tomorrow, 10th December, is the 23rd anniversary of the conferment of Nobel Peace Prize to His Holiness. In the morning, around 9 a.m., in the courtyard of Debung Losaneng, there will be speeches by His Holiness and by Indian and Tibetan representatives. An award will be presented to His Holiness by the Gelugpa tradition of Tibetan Buddhism in recognition of his extraordinary contribution to humanity. The program will be translated, so everyone is welcome to attend. Thank you.